The next case is 04-1770, Disciplinary Counsel versus Sandra K. Hunter. Ms. Sabella.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Mary L. Sabella, and I represent Sandra K. Hunter, the respondent in this matter. Mr. Chief Justice, may I please reserve at least 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal? Thank you. Section 10b2g of the guidelines to impose lawyer sanctions specifically provides for mitigation for chemical dependency and for mental disability, provided four elements are met. Those four elements are a diagnosis of either chemical dependency or mental disability, that the chemical dependency or the mental disability contributed to cause the misconduct, that there was a sustained period of successful treatment, and the fourth, there is a prognosis from a medical professional that the attorney is able to return to the competent practice of law. Mrs. Hunter met all four of those elements, and in addition to that, she also proved that her mental disorder, major depressive disorder, was in fact mental illness under 5122.01A, that definition has been adopted as part of the disciplinary process. We submit that the DSM-IV is the medical professional's standard for diagnosing mental disorders. Major depressive disorder, which Mrs. Hunter has and had, is a mental disorder under the DSM-IV. Chemical dependency is a mental disorder under the DSM-IV. The medical profession makes no distinction between their mental disorders. They're all mental disorders under the standard of the DSM-IV. In addition, medical profession, through scientific study, has determined that both chemical dependency and major depressive disorder are in fact neurologic disorders of the brain. We respectively submit that the Equal Protection Clauses of the Ohio and the U.S. Constitution do not permit the mental disorder of chemical dependency to be given more weight in mitigation in a disciplinary case than the major depressive disorder as mitigation in the disciplinary case. Yes,
Counsel,
Your Honor.
Usually in major depressive disorder cases that we see up here, we see a pattern of neglect. Clients don't return phone calls, they don't prepare the forms, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The problem I have, and you know I'm really big on this issue, and so I'm very sympathetic to the mental health issues, but the problem I have in this case is you have affirmative acts taken by your client, which are not really indicative of someone in a depressive state. Usually they fail to act. 100 checks that she writes over a period of time, I mean, all the things that she does really take thought, preparing a loan to cover up the theft. I mean, these things are all things that require active participation, and it makes it very difficult to have the link between the depression and the misappropriation. Then you couple that with the examples you cite, and most of them are drug and alcohol related to neglect. Only one was related to active theft, and that was a fairly small matter. So I need to understand, what medical evidence did you present that linked her affirmative acts of fraud and concealment and theft to a depressive state?
Okay.
I'm having a very difficult time
okay.
to connect.
Dr. Hussler was specifically asked at the trial, were Ms. Hunter's acts of dishonesty, did her major depressive disorder contribute to her acts of dishonesty? And he said, yes. Clearly, her judgment was affected, her ability to think clearly was affected, her mental process, if you will, was affected. And if you look through all of this, part of what Ms. Hunter is being charged with is not timely sending bills to Mrs. Lester, not timely responding to her telephone calls. That is what you typically see in major depressive disorder. The problem is a mental disorder is, if you will, is a dysfunction of the brain caused by some chemical imbalance. The medical profession has determined that those imbalances are such that there are a variety of different things that will affect the way a person acts. And in fact, one of the effects of Mrs. Hunter's major depressive disorder was to do these checks. She had practiced for a number of years. She was admitted in 77, didn't do any of this behavior until her depressive disorder came about because she wasn't thinking clearly. She was doing acts that she would not have otherwise done but for the depressive disorder.
Counsel, the diagnosis is mild, though. A mild depressive disorder?
No. Currently, it's mild, Your Honor.
Currently?
In June of 2001, when Dr. Hutzler diagnosed Ms. Hunter, he indicated that her disease was florid. She had major depressive disorder, single episode, with severe stressors.
Was she hospitalized?
He did not hospitalize her. He determined that...
Pardon me?
He did not hospitalize her. He determined that through psychotherapy and the other treatments that she was receiving, that she was not a danger to herself, meaning that she wasn't going to commit suicide, nor was she going to go out and kill somebody else. That's typically when
you
hospitalize someone.
Well, that's not the only basis for hospitalization, injury to yourself or others, hospitalization is a standard treatment for someone who is so deep in a psychosis that their judgment is of the nature which you've described here.
Okay, well, Your Honor, I believe you're confusing psychotic, which is delusions and an inability to understand reality, from major depressive disorder, which is a dysfunction of the brain.
No, I'm not confusing psychotic with...
Okay.
I know the difference.
Okay, well...
I ask you, as you know, the relator has indicated that the respondent here continued to engage in her misconduct, at least with respect to the Grunstein estate or funds, while she's being treated. Is that in her favor or is that against her favor?
Well, she was treated for 5 months by Dr. Hart from January of 2000 to May of 2000, and we would submit that that treatment was not effective. If you look at her testimony in the record, what she said was she would go to Dr. Hart's office and she would pretty much sit there and cry the entire time, as opposed to the effective treatment that she received beginning in June of 2001 with both Drs. Hutzler and Dr. Rogers. They were giving her coping mechanisms. They were helping her to understand when she was so stressed that she needed to step back and stop and she needed to do other things. They were giving her the ability to understand her disease and how she can manage her disease to be competent. And
Counsel, did she manage her disease with medications?
She did not take antidepressive medications.
No prescriptions, just therapy.
Well, as Dr. Hutzler indicated, she took psychotherapy, and he also agreed with her that she could do meditation, she could do acupuncture, she could do take natural remedies, and that he has about, I believe you said, close to 50% of his patients that use more natural remedies to treat their disease, and provided he sees progress, he's okay with that. And in fact, he did see progress, and there was a period of time where her disease was in remission, if you will, but the ongoing nature of this process and the fact that it was up and down for 3 years caused her to slip back, and that's why she now has major depressive disorder, mild. That's her current diagnosis. Yes, Your Honor.
Was it her choice not to take medication, or was it the doctor's decision?
The doctor, Dr. Hutzler, had prescribed medication. She discussed with him that she preferred more natural remedies. They discussed it, and he agreed with her that her more natural remedies were acceptable to him, provided he saw progress, and he, in fact, did see that progress. And if I can go back to Justice Stratton, I don't think one of the questions, or part of the question that you asked me was answered. And we would submit that relator's suggestion that the facts, misconduct, and disciplinary rule violations in the cases cited by respondent to support the equal protection argument, that they're not the same. We would respectfully submit that there are similarities, and if I might take a minute to do that.
Counsel, if you would, your brief does not talk about an alternate sanction.
Yes,
the relator,
Your Honor,
is talking about indefinite suspension. What would, in fact, be a sufficient sanction in this case?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, in the cases that we cited, there's a range of sanction anywhere from 6 months suspension to 2 years suspension with part of the suspension stayed with very specific conditions. And as I outlined at the hearing, specific conditions would, in fact, be continued treatment. And I will tell the court that Dr. Hutzler is retiring in May of this year, but he is already making arrangements to transfer her care to one of his colleagues that he is convinced has the capacity to continue on with her case, that she continues with that care, that in fact she has a monitored attorney appointed who would in fact monitor her practice, and that as part of the monitoring she would agree that she would tell every client who came into her that she is being monitored, and that if the client does not agree to allow the monitoring attorney to have some access to her case, then she would decline that case. Or in the alternative would associate with co-counsel, and the co-counsel would then be required to communicate with the monitoring attorney that in fact she's either doing everything she's supposed to be doing or she's not. And that, and she's already made the restitution. That was one of the other elements that we had suggested. If I might go back to the cases for a minute. In the Boss case, she took retainers and did not perform services. This court has said in Cleveland Bar versus Gladkey, disciplinary counsel versus Nasrallah, and disciplinary counsel versus Siegel, that taking retainers, not providing services, is tantamount to misappropriation. We would suggest that case is similar. In Shaffron, he misappropriated monies from his client's pension fund. Clearly, there's a misappropriation. That is similar. In Bowman, he took $86,000 in attorney's fees and fiduciary fees without court approval. That's also an allegation in the current case.
Could you distinguish the Hallows case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The Hallows case?
The House?
Hallows. He got disbarred. It's in the brief of your opponent.
Okay.
He took money from his child's trust fund.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm taking a minute to look at my list here. I apologize. I don't see that case, but I will suggest to you that there were cases that disciplinary counsel cited to support their proposition for their sanction, and Weaver Lance Abluda. I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing that name. Schwartz, Allison Knott. And Gladkey were all defaults, meaning that the respondents didn't appear and there wasn't any mitigation. And in most of the indefinite suspension cases, there was no mental disability raised in the way of mitigation. And I'm sorry, I apologize, Your Honor. I just don't recall that specific case. The only thing I can presume is that the court did not find sufficient mitigation to deviate, because the court has said if in fact there's sufficient mitigation, they can deviate.
He was a former prosecutor, former FBI agent. He had a lot of good things he had done in his life, and alcohol took control of his life, so he had that
mitigation. And did in fact they prove the four elements, Your Honor? Because this court has said that those are the four elements that must be proven in order, that there must be a contributing to cause the misconduct. You have to find that causal factor for there to be the mitigation.
Well, this Marine Council, on that same point, this Marine Council, as you know, in its brief, indicates that the cases that you've cited in support of a lesser sanction, I guess, are none of them. Right, the conduct doesn't rise to the level that we see here, a sort of pattern, not one client, but more than one, and $300,000 taken, and the clients were harmed. What is your strongest case that's on, there's no case on all fours, but what's your strongest case to urge that we've decided previously.
Okay. My strongest case, Your Honor, is Dayton Bar Association versus Gurin, because that case, the court stated with respect to misappropriation, it is immaterial whether the amount at stake is large or small, meaning that what is punished is the act. And we would submit that there were two clients, and what you should punish is the act of misappropriation and not be swayed by the dollar amount, because this court has previously said that that's immaterial. And for the so the court is fully aware, and this goes with the Disciplinary Council versus Norris case. Last Thursday, Ms. Hunter pled guilty to a one-count information in Cuyahoga County. That one-count information evolves out of the Grunstein matter. The prosecutor at the plea hearing made a motion to dismiss the second count of the information, which the second count arose out of the WIC matter. And Ms. Hunter went yesterday to the probation authorities, and it will be sentenced on April 13th.
And did you, Counselor, did you say a misdemeanor?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did you say a misdemeanor?
No, it's a felony, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I'm up me. I can.
Sure.
It's a felony. She's pled guilty to an information, one-count felony in Grunstein.
Felony
arising out of Grunstein.
Is that felony five or four, do you know?
It's a felony four, I believe. My recollection is the potential sanction is probation or 6 to 18 months imprisonment. And presumably that will be decided on April 13th when the court sentences her.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Mr. Berger.
May it please the court, Robert Berger for Relator, Office of Disciplinary Counsel. In this matter, Sandra K. Hunter misappropriated over $300,000 from an incompetent ward and an out-of-state client. Respondent Sandra K. Hunter engaged in conduct and made statements that were dishonest to clients, opposing counsel, the probate court, and Relator. Respondent Sandra K. Hunter failed to make full and prompt restitution. And finally, respondent Sandra K. Hunter failed to accept full responsibility for her misconduct and testify candidly at the disciplinary hearing. Based upon this misconduct, the board recommended an indefinite suspension. Respondent Hunter suggests that a lesser sanction is merited, but a lesser sanction is not supported by this court's prior case law, by the clear and convincing evidence of respondent's misconduct, and by the aggravating factors that are present in this matter. Misappropriation. Respondent Hunter served as guardian, attorney, trustee, and executor in two legal matters.
Counsel, if you would, could you discuss both the mitigating and or the aggravating and the mitigating factor? We've heard of the diagnosis for mental illness as being a significant mitigating factor, having the advocate for Ms. Hunter stating that it squares on all fours with what we require to show a mental illness affecting the ability to practice law, the recovery, et cetera, et cetera. What's your assessment of that, as well as any aggravating?
Aggravating factors present in this matter include the over 160 banking transactions utilized by Respondent Hunter to misappropriate funds in the Grunstein matter. Also an aggravating factor is the fact that when Evelyn Grunstein was in hospice on her deathbed, Respondent Hunter realized she was about to be exposed and misappropriated an additional $100,000 from the WIC Trust to cover up her misappropriation in the Grunstein matter. Further, Respondent Hunter continued to conceal that misappropriation, and during an inquiry by the attorney for the Grunstein estate and the probate court, Respondent Hunter declined to reveal her second misappropriation in the WIC matter and instead used manipulation and sympathy to obtain dishonestly obtained letter from Virginia Lester claiming that the $100,000 was a loan. Further, after Respondent Hunter could no longer misappropriate funds, she began collecting fees that were excessive and improper. At the beginning of the representation in the WIC estate and trust matter, respondent Hunter told Virginia Lester her fees would be an estimated $25,000. Instead, respondent Hunter charged over $100,000 in fees, which total over 7% of the entire value of the estate and trust. Additionally, a review of those fee forms show that respondent Hunter charged attorney fee rates for non-legal administrative tasks, such as paying the bills, picking up the mail, arranging for lawn care. Respondent Hunter also engaged in a lengthy pattern of dishonesty throughout this entire proceeding. First, respondent Hunter, when she was writing herself the checks in the Grunstein matter, noted on the checks in the memo line that they were attorney fees, fees, or a business loan to herself, even though the probate court had not approved any such action. When the probate court made an inquiry...
Could you interrupt yourself and go to mitigation and then come back to that? I don't want you to use up your time on the aggravating.
Certainly. Respondent claims that her mitigation merits further reduction of the sanction, a lesser sanction. The court's case law is clear. The presumptive sanction for misappropriation of client funds is disbarment. Relator argues that the sanction recommended by the board in this matter is appropriate. Respondent has already received substantial credit for her mitigation evidence in that they did not recommend she be disbarred from the practice of law for misappropriating over $300,000 and engaging in a course of dishonest conduct.
Was there any expert testimony presented that disputed the link between the conduct and the act, or was there a cross-examination of the doctor? What evidence did the board have that there was no relationship?
There were two examinations done of the respondent, one by a doctor appointed by the board who did not testify, but his report was submitted into evidence, and his conclusion was that she suffered from major depression during the time of the misconduct. He did not create a causal link between the two. At the hearing, Dr. Hutzler testified that there was a relationship between the two, but it's certainly in dispute whether or not he testified that there was a causal connection and that her misconduct was clearly caused by her depression. Her diagnosis, major depressive disorder, does not have dishonesty as a symptom. And further, Your Honor, as you pointed out earlier, if you examine the majority of cases that use depression as a mitigating factor normally, there's also neglect that goes hand in hand with it. Normally with depression, the person's avoiding work. They're not returning calls. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. In this matter, respondent's counsel suggested that her failure to send Virginia Lester bills and her failure to return calls to Virginia Lester was a result of her depression. If you examine the evidence, she wasn't not sending her bills because she was depressed. She was not sending her bills because she didn't want her to know the fraudulent billing she was engaging in. The respondent did not return Virginia Lester's calls because she did not want to deal, to be confronted with the fact that she had misappropriated funds and had not repaid the funds, had not provided a promissory note, had not lived up to all the promises that she made during the time that she negotiated this loan with Virginia Lester.
Has there been full restitution now? Is there agreement on that?
The restitution issue is one that relator disputes respondent's characterization. In the Grunstein matter, respondent misappropriated funds from the WIC estate and trust to repay the funds she had misappropriated in the Grunstein matter. Relator's position on this is the same as the board's. Misappropriating from one client to repay a misappropriation from another client, while at the same time concealing that misappropriation from all the parties involved, is not restitution as envisioned as mitigation. Right. It's theft.
Let me rephrase it. How much money are the various people that this lady's touched out at this point?
In the Grunstein matter, it was resolved based upon money she had repaid and the $100,000 that had been misappropriated. In the WIC matter, respondent originally promised to repay the $100,000 within 2 months at 7% interest, 8% for late payments. Instead, over 3 years later, Virginia Lester was forced to hire an attorney and file an action in probate court. The matter was eventually settled between all of the parties, but that settlement does not include full payment for all the interest that was originally agreed to, reimbursement to Lester for the attorney fees that she incurred, which were substantial, or repayment for any of the fraudulent billing that the board found Respondent had engaged in. Respondent also engaged in a series of dishonest acts with all of the parties in this matter. With regard to the attorney for the Grunstein estate, he spoke with her on the telephone and said, "It looks like there's some money missing here." She told him she would look into it, and from that point forward, Respondent refused to return any telephone calls to the attorney for the Grunstein estate.
Let me, Mr. Berger, I'm going to keep taking you back. We read the briefs, and we know what the case is, what the facts are. I want to pick up on Justice Stratton's question. I'm still curious about the mitigation. Ms. Sabella makes a strong argument that the respondent here was severely depressed, and you responded somewhat to that, but what is the importance in your mind of your inclusion in your brief that she was engaging in this dishonest conduct while she was being treated by Dr. Hart? Does that suggest a more strict sanction for her or a lesser sanction? I would assume a stricter sanction since it's in your brief, but why?
That's correct, Your Honor. First of all, let me state, Respondent suggests in her brief that her depression prevented her from having a dishonest or selfish motive, and that's not supported by the evidence. At the hearing, Respondent testified she knew her actions were misconduct when she was misappropriating the funds. Further, as I mentioned before, dishonesty is not a symptom of her diagnosis. Additionally, the crime that she pleaded guilty to includes a knowing element. She knew what she was doing at the time, and that's supported by the actions that she took. After she began treatment with Dr. Hart, she continued to misappropriate funds from the Grunstein guardianship. After her treatment with Dr. Hutzler and Dr. Rogers, she still did not disclose the Grunstein misappropriation until months later, after a motion to surcharge had been filed and a hearing had been scheduled. She did not reveal the WIC misappropriation to the court or the attorney for the state and did not reveal it to Virginia Lester until she was forced to, so that she could obtain a letter stating that it was a loan and she could obtain dismissal of the Grunstein surcharge matter. Respondent's dishonesty continued throughout her treatment with these doctors. Additionally, she promised Virginia Lester to repay the funds within 2 months, failed to do so. She promised Virginia Lester she would send her a promissory note immediately, did not do so for 17 months. Even though Respondent was supposedly in this treatment that was characterized by Respondent's counsel as effective, she was engaging in conduct that was misleading, deceptive, and dishonest. And for that reason, we believe the sanction recommended by the board is appropriate. She's already received substantial mitigation credit. Respondent's dishonesty continued beyond the actual pendency of the Grunstein and the WIC matters. At a January 2003 deposition, prior to Relator being aware Respondent had misappropriated $100,000 in the WIC matter, Relator asked Respondent, "Have you improperly taken funds from any other clients?" Respondent testified no. Further, the board found that the Respondent testified without candor during the disciplinary hearing. Respondent made two large withdrawals from the Grunstein matter, a check she cashed for herself for $31,000 and a withdrawal for $83,000. Respondent is unable to explain what happened to that money. There are no bank records indicating a redeposit, there are no receipts indicating expenditures, and she blames her depression on an inability to recall. The board found that to be a serious lack of candor based upon the fact she was completing and billing for legal work for the Grunstein matter during the time she was taking these funds, and based upon the fact she attempted to explain away the funds by saying she utilized them in opening her new law practice. Her new law practice was not opened until a year and 7 months after those withdrawals. So there's a big question as to what happened with those funds. Such a big question that the board recommended Respondent be required to account for where that $114,000 went to prior to being readmitted to the practice of law. One additional issue I'd like to address a little bit further is all of the things that respondent was able to do during her depression. Even though respondent was immobilized by her depression, she had the ability to realize when Evelyn Grunstein was on her deathbed that she needed to come up with some funds to conceal her misappropriation, and did so. Further, she continued to conceal that misappropriation at every turn until she was confronted or forced to reveal it. Even though respondent was suffering from debilitating depression, she was able to contact Virginia Lester and negotiate a $100,000 misappropriation into a loan. Respondent used a tale of woe and tears to convince Virginia Lester that she should turn the $100,000 misappropriation into a loan and create a letter that respondent could then use to obtain dismissal of the Grunstein motion to surcharge. And when respondent spoke with Virginia Lester, she did not disclose to her that she had misappropriated funds in the Grunstein matter, that she had used the funds misappropriated in the WIC matter to repay the Grunstein misappropriation, or that she needed this loan letter in order to resolve the surcharge motion that was pending against her. Instead, she told Lester, "I used the monies for the startup costs of my law practice." She actively misled Lester, even though she was in the midst and had been receiving treatment from Dr. Hutzler and Dr. Rogers for at least 4 months, in addition to the 5 months of treatment she received previously from Dr. Hart. Respondent cites a wide variety of case law in this matter in support of the sanction that they propose, but respondent's case law does not apply in this matter. It's clear if you want to determine the appropriate sanction for misappropriation, you consult case law that deals with misappropriation. The one case cited by respondent that dealt with misappropriation, Guerin, is completely different. In the Guerin matter, the relator recommended a stayed suspension. The misconduct was identified as an isolated incident. The respondent was cooperative, contrite, and there was no violation of DR 1102A4. In this matter, relator requested disbarment.
You need to sum up, Mr.
There was a clear pattern of misconduct, and respondent stipulated to a violation of disciplinary rule 1102A4. The respondent in this matter misappropriated over $300,000, engaged in a pattern of dishonest conduct, failed to make full and prompt restitution as envisioned by the rules, failed to accept full responsibility for her misconduct and testify candidly. And for these reasons, we request the board's recommendation of an indefinite suspension be adopted. Thank you.
Ms. Sabella, you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me begin with a question. It certainly does appear that the board took into account, by first stating this looks like a disbarment case, and I agree with the board, except that they took into account the mitigation, the mental health condition, and recommended, of course, as you know, an indefinite suspension. How would we write this case if we were to adopt your recommendation that essentially she doesn't serve any time out, as I understand it? Your most recent recommendation is to leave it to us, but this is pretty severe conduct, and but for the mental health condition, it seems to me that as the board says, we're gonna give her credit for the mitigation, and we're gonna give her mitigation because of her mental health condition.
Okay.
What's your response?
Well, first, Your Honor, since this court is the ultimate determiner of facts in a disciplinary case, I would urge this honorable court to review closely respondent's brief, because I would, as we had posited in respondent's brief, there were other mitigation factors that we believe the board did not perceive as mitigation, and in fact, the evidence supports that, in fact, they are mitigation. In addition to that, as Dr. Hutzler testified, Ms. Hunter's ability to understand right from wrong was inhibited by her mental disorder, her disease, and the attempt to apply a reasonable attorney standard when someone is mentally ill, we submit, is problematic. And I would suggest to you, Your Honor, in response to your question, that that is a basis to make that finding. And if you look closely at the cases that were cited in the brief, the court does talk about recognizing that when someone has a chemical dependency or depression, that they're mentally ill, and you can't judge them the same way as somebody who's not mentally ill. And with respect to WIC and the restitution, Mrs. Lester raised by February of 2004 for the first time fee dispute issues and potential legal malpractice issues. Respectfully submit that if Ms. Hunter didn't tell Mrs. Lester, go get another lawyer and have your lawyer come and bring those charges forward, that Ms. Hunter would have been charged with something else in addition for not telling her client at the time, you have issues that put us in conflict, now go get your own lawyer. And with respect to the $60,000 that was—
If she would have repaid the money, she wouldn't have had to give that advice.
Except, Your Honor, that what was outstanding of the loan was $41,000 plus interest. She'd already paid $59,000 in principal and over $19,000 in interest. The $41,000 plus interest was never in dispute. She had acknowledged that she was going to pay that. The only problem was she didn't have the wherewithal to pay it by the time the hearing came. Ms. Lester then raised additional issues in February of 2004 of excessive fees and alleged malpractice for the advice that Ms. Hunter gave with respect to disclaimers that Ms. Lester made to bring things either in back into the estate or to give to the other heirs from the trust. Once those issues were raised, we respectfully submit there was a conflict. She had to get another lawyer to come in and present her things, because if she would have attempted to resolve the malpractice issue directly with her, she would have been sanctioned. That's the Klavner case.
Well, another lawyer hadn't taken a look at that case until Mrs. Lester decided she needed to get a lawyer, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Another lawyer had not taken a look at the way your client had performed her legal duties, aside from dipping into the funds, but the actual legal responsibilities, correct?
Yes, it was when Ms. Hunter told Ms. Lester, go get your separate independent counsel, that in addition to the fee dispute issues that Ms. Lester raised personally, there was also the malpractice claims came forward.
All right, thank you.
And
you've used your time, Ms. Sibilla.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.